The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Banned Book Week takes place at the end of September, but Aloud is getting a jump on it tonight as we present Rick Wortsman and William Devereaux exploring the significance of the burning and banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Steinbeck's masterpiece was banned by the Kern County Board of Supervisors from local public schools and libraries from August 1939 to January 1941. When W.B. Bill Camp, a cotton and potato grower, presided over its burning in downtown Bakersfield, he declared, "We are angry not because we were attacked, but because we were attacked by a book obscene in the extreme sense of the word." A brave Kern County librarian who pleaded with county supervisors to lift the ban is one of the heroes in Rick Wortsman's new book, which we will discuss tonight. "If that book is banned today," she asked, "what book will be banned tomorrow?" That librarian would not have been surprised to learn that just a few years ago, it is said, a certain mayor of a certain small town in Alaska wanted to ban some books from the local library, books she considered offensive, when the city library and then the city librarian refused. So as we can see, the fight goes on. And if you look on the National Banned Book Week's website, you can see the roll call of honor of all the books that have been threatened over the years. It's quite an impressive list. And Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, is another one that's frequently on that list. Since it was in Bakersfield that the banning took place, it was heartening to read the glowing review of Rick Wortsman's book yesterday in the Bakersfield Californian. In Bakersfield, the banning was orchestrated by rich local growers, men who were busy exploiting scores of Joad families, the very men Steinbeck exposed in the novel. Tonight, we'll learn the larger historical implications of that act of censorship and its relevance to today when, as Wortsman notes, the central conundrum of capitalism is the same now as it was in 1939. How can there be so much lack in the midst of so much plenty? Rick Wortsman is director of the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University, an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and a columnist for Businessweek magazine. He spent two decades as a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. And he's the co-author with Mark Erics of The King of California, J.G. Boswell, and the Making of a Secret American Empire. A bestseller, it won, among other honors, a California Book Award and the William Saroyan International Prize for Writing. And in conversation with Rick tonight, and you will be in very good hands, is William Devereaux. Bill is a professor of history at USC and the director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. He's the author of Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles and the Remaking of Its Mexican Past, and his book, as well as Rick's book, is on sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. And as well, he's the author of Railroad Crossing, Californians and the Railroad, and with Greg Heiss, the co-author of Eden by Design, the 1930 Olmsted-Bartholomew Plan for the Los Angeles Region. We'll open it up to you for questions after our conversation. We ask that you do wait for the microphone to come around as we do record for podcast. And books will be for sale afterwards. So please welcome Rick Wortsman and William Devereaux. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Louise, and thanks to you all for joining us tonight for what I'm sure will be a really stimulating and wonderful conversation, both with our featured guest as well as with all of you in your comments and questions that follow our slightly formal discussion with one another. It's a great pleasure to be here with my colleague Rick Wortsman. As Louise pointed out, Rick has distinguished himself as a writer and interpreter of California through now two quite important and wonderful books, well-crafted books, carefully written books, deeply researched books, books that are both play off one another and books that are in some respects quite different from one another. And of course, we're here tonight to talk specifically about Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of the Grapes of Wrath. So with that, I just want to open up a question to Rick. How did you find yourself moving along a path that led you to write this book?
Great. First of all, thanks for such a kind introduction, and to Louise as well. It's great to see so many people out here. I came across this story really doing the research for The King of California, the book, first book I wrote with Mark Arax. There was a picture that had run of the book burning in Bakersfield, and it shows Bill Camp, this giant agribusiness titan, big cotton and potato grower, sort of presiding over this book burning where one of his farm workers is dropping the grapes of wrath into a pail, and you can see some of the flames shooting out of it. And Bill Camp's a minor character in The King of California, but that photograph, as you might imagine, it always kind of stayed with me. And I actually was at a book reading for the first book in Bakersfield, and a friend of mine, a poet named Lee McCarthy, she and I were chatting in the parking lot at Russo's, great bookstore if you ever happen to go to Bakersfield. And somehow this photograph came up. We were talking about Bill Camp, and she said, oh, you know about that photograph? And I said, yeah, I've actually seen that. And boy, it was just, it's indelible. It was just right in my head. And then she said, you know about the librarian? I said, no, I don't know anything about the librarian. And she started telling me about this woman, Gretchen Neef, and she said, oh, she fought the censorship. She was really brave. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. I wonder if there's a story there. And 4 years later, there was a story there.
It's amazing. So you came to the book more or less out of research and things you tripped upon with the King of California project. How, in your own education, maybe as a younger person, how did the Grapes of Wrath resonate with you and then eventually putting these two stories together?
You know, I read the Grapes of Wrath in high school, like probably everybody sitting here. And I had read it several more times. I had read it most recently while writing The King of California. That was one of many books that I had read, in part because The King of California, which is really about this giant cotton empire, Steinbeck writes a lot about these giant cotton growers in the Grapes of Wrath. So I read the novel again. But what was interesting is until I started doing the research for Obscene in the Extreme, I read the book again. I read The Grapes of Wrath again, obviously, and I read it in an entirely new way, which is to say, at first I was, and Louise and I were talking about this before, so captivated by the narrative, by the Jodes family's struggle and their story of being tugged across the country and all the things that they went through, that I didn't quite read over, but I didn't appreciate the inner chapters where Steinbeck, it's this narrator's voice, and as I started to learn more about the politics of the 1930s, and particularly the politics of California in the 1930s, and this deep left-right divide, and I started to read those inner chapters, you know, it suddenly hit me. I was like, wow, this guy was calling for a revolution. This was incredible stuff. I mean, the radical nature of the writing is really something. And I began to understand, you know, frankly, if you were part of the establishment, why you would want to get rid of that book. And you know, it really scared the hell out of people. And so, anyway, I read it with a whole different lens.
And then in the notion of Camp and others who pushed to burn and ban the book, the notion of the obscenity in the extreme, for them, that's what? Is it the politics and laying bare the struggles of the 1930s, particularly in the Central Valley? Or is it more, as we all learned probably as school kids, it's that closing bit, that Rose of Sharon bit? So where's the obscenity fulcrum there?
You know, I think that it was obscene in several ways in the eyes of the establishment. And really in Kern County in particular, which again, of course, as you should remember well from high school English, this is where the Jodes end up settling in the novel in Kern County. And, they opposed the book on three grounds, and they were explicit about this, which is interesting. They're not very subtle folks. They were very explicit about this in the resolution, the Board of Supervisors resolution banning the book. So they did ban it on obscenity grounds of profanity, lewdness, and so on. And the book was actually banned or censored in different ways around the country. And this was the grounds that it was mainly censored upon. So in Buffalo, New York, the librarian actually there refused just to buy copies of The Grapes of Wrath at all and have them in the library. And this actually happened in a couple places in San Francisco and in Detroit. And in New Jersey, it was kept on closed shelves because of the sensitive nature of the language. In East St. Louis, there were copies of the book that were actually burned. In Illinois, and in Kansas City, Missouri, it was also banned on obscenity grounds. And it was the scene, a lot of people were offended by the scene of Rosa Sharon breastfeeding this starving man at the end of the book. And there's, say by today's HBO standards, it's hard to be shocked or by the language, but in the context of the time, some people genuinely found it shocking, and in fact, even critics who praised the book, like Joseph Henry Jackson, the San Francisco literary critic who loved the book and was a friend of Steinbeck's, he thought that many people would find this novel shocking, that it broke new ground in terms of the way it used language. Steinbeck was unapologetic about it. In fact, he spent a lot of time in the farm fields. He got a lot of actual reports, government reports, that really chronicled the way the migrants, the Okies, spoke. And he thought that to change their speech in any way was really to do a disservice to the truthful nature of the book, and he refused to change any of the language. So it was obscene. I think genuinely people were shocked by it on some level, certainly a group of people. There was, for the folks in Kern County, they took particular offense at the way the community was portrayed. Right, these powers that be were made out to be vigilantes and to have obviously abused and mistreated their migrant laborers, and they didn't like that very much. And again, the real facts are kind of gray. There are certainly many big growers who exploited their workers, no doubt about it. The Associated Farmers, this big growers group of which Bill Camp was the president in Kern County, could be particularly vicious, and as you well know, Bill, would settle, strikes with, tire irons and chains, and I mean, it was a really rough time. At the same time, Kern County, actually the public hospital system, they gave free public health care to the migrants in the most extensive public hospital system anywhere in rural California. In some cases, the Board of Supervisors had actually done some good things to try and bring decent housing, or at least relatively speaking, to this mass of humanity that had poured in. And remember, the other side of this is, through the 30s, this is 400,000 people who came out of what's commonly called the Dust Bowl, but the Plain States, the Parched Plain States, the Southwest, settled in California, many of them in the Central Valley. And they're really straining services. Mm-hmm. Taxes went way up. Services are stretched thin. There is kind of another piece to this. It's not so simple. But they took offense at the way they were portrayed. They called it a lie. It wasn't quite a lie, but it maybe wasn't the full picture that Steinbeck was providing. So in that sense, as you framed it, I think they thought that was obscene, the way they were portrayed.
And I know we want to develop some of the characters that you've developed in the book, and Rick has offered to read from the book itself. Before we do that, let's talk just a brief minute about Steinbeck and his perception of the purpose of the book. Because Steinbeck famously, first of all, Steinbeck destroyed, as I understand it, destroyed an original draft of the book, unhappy with it, displeased with it. And then famously, he writes to his editor, who's essentially saying to him, "Where's the book? Where's the book? Where's the book?" And he's apologizing for the delay, in essence, although not particularly apologetic, by saying, "I'm trying to write history while it's happening, and I don't want to be wrong." So he's writing a fictional book. He's writing what can be argued to be one of the great American novels, and yet he's really motivated by the non-fictional purposes of this. Is part of the obscenity of the book the belief that Steinbeck is actually setting out, as you put it, to write a highly political tract, fiction or otherwise, that has this very large purpose, which, as you put it, is revolution? Do they glean that kind of antagonism?
Absolutely. And that's the third and final reason. They actually refer to it as well in the Board of Supervisors resolution, which is they accuse Steinbeck of breathing class hatred, or saying that portraying the community for breathing class hatred. And that was really the last piece, and that's when I realized there was a book here, which is to say that the reaction to this novel really is a window into the class politics of the 30s. There is no doubt that John Steinbeck was trying to shake things up. I mean, he was pretty explicit about that in letters to friends. He talked about going out in the farm fields, and when there was particular labor strife, it was interesting. He said, you know, there are two ways this thing can play. One is that people get so beaten down that, and you might expect that, that they would just, you know, that would be the end of it. But sometimes they get so mad that you can feel something revolutionary about to happen, and I can sense it, and it excited him. I mean, he talked matter-of-factly about, as a lot of leading intellectuals did in the 30s, right? Remember, capitalism really felt dead. And he said, I have no doubt that we're pretty close to the point where the private means of production in America are just about over. I mean, he really foresaw some form of socialism coming, as did a lot of people. And so this was, I think, really the reason that this book was so feared. You know, the whole context of where California was is hugely important. In 1934, Upton Sinclair, longtime socialist, turned Democrat for that election, almost becomes the governor of California, right? Incredible. Really a close election. Wins the Democratic nomination, a huge smear campaign, kind of foreshadowing a lot of the nasty politics that would, you know, we'd see to this day, really unfolded and were perfected in that 1934 campaign. 4 years later, Colbert Olson, an Upton Sinclair protege, a political protege anyway, wins and becomes the first Democratic governor elected in California in the 20th century, breaks this Republican stronghold. He turns around and he makes the head of his state farm worker policy none other than Cary McWilliams. Cary McWilliams, who had just written a book called Factories in the Field. A lot of people saw this as the nonfiction counterpart to The Grapes of Wrath. Factories in the Field, the end of it's extraordinary. And Cary McWilliams, who frankly is an amazing man, was an amazing man, a real hero of mine in terms of his fighting for civil liberties. But think how shocking this must have been if you were a farmer, whether you own 20 acres or 10,000 acres. The end of this book, and now this is the guy in charge of farm worker policy, calls for the Soviet-style collectivization of all private agriculture in California.
Right.
Holy moly. And, you know, now he's not just, as I say, a nuisance with a pen anymore.
Right.
He's in power. So this is a very scary time. You have communist labor leaders, openly communist, trying to organize the farm fields very actively. You have quasi-fascists bashing their heads in. You know, these incredible clashes of left and right. San Francisco, right, that, you know, literally had open warfare on its streets just several years before, right, with Harry Bridges. I mean, this is incredible time. And then here comes this novel, and it flies off the shelves. Sold 430,000 copies its first year. You know, huge, nation's number one bestseller. It's calling for revolution. So as I describe it, California was one of those spots in America that really was like a tinderbox. And I think the establishment was afraid that this book, The Grapes of Wrath, could be the match.
And do you think that you've written elsewhere about this, which is really provocative and interesting, about California history in the 30s, that oftentimes we think about the New Deal programs of the 30s as addressing symptomatic problems of the Depression. Or addressing, in some respects, the worst of the Depression without perhaps getting at some of the root causes of the Great Depression economically. Do you think that these tectonic struggles that you characterize in California, of which this is clearly a part, are actually the center stage of the Depression era in California over and above New Deal programs? In other words, perhaps the New Deal doesn't really get a foothold here because the level of antagonism between capital and labor, right and left, is so seismic that characterizes California more.
It would be easy to overstate that the New Deal didn't gain a foothold or wasn't a big deal here, because it was, obviously, including through some of the very important farm programs, right, the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and the farm worker programs. I mean, Steinbeck himself writes about the importance of these New Deal labor camps, where the Joads ultimately settle and they find a measure of comfort and support in there. And Steinbeck, in that way, was really saying, hey, this is government intervention is an important piece of the puzzle here, right? It's an important part of the answer. But at the same time, I think you're right. I think that the spirit of the New Deal in a lot of ways, which was really about saving capitalism by bringing labor and industry together, right? That's really what a lot of it was about, was really missing here. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I mean, you see that played out in some ways with Culbert Olson's election. It wasn't until 1938 he's elected. He's not inaugurated till 1939. You know, California then is for the first time ushering in the New Deal, and the New Deal's almost over.
Right.
I mean, you know, as right, I've described it as, you know, it's like there was this big party and all the guests are putting on their coats to leave, and here comes California finally saying, here we are.
Right. And I know Rick's offered to read a couple of passages in the book that sort of set the stage and begin to open up some of the issues around the characters that he's not only found but developed. And so with that, I'd be happy to have you read some of it.
That's great. Yeah, the way this book works is it all takes place over 1 week in Kern County. So it's a very sort of small, tight, locally driven and focused narrative. But again, the canvas is huge because many of the characters take you to these bigger themes and events of the era. In some cases, they were directly involved. In other cases, they had some sort of connection to these bigger things. But really, in some ways, the fight does come down, you know, on the banning itself, to these two characters on the board of supervisors. And one is a guy named Stanley Abel, as I describe him, this big, gruff, thick-necked guy who was to the far right, even in Kern County. He was not at the time the chairman of the board of supervisors, but he really ran the show. He had served for a very long time and was really the kind of political force in the county. And then you had a guy who was relatively new to the board named Ralph Lavin, and Ralph Lavin was the only one who actually opposed the censorship, was the only one who fought it. And so I kind of set up there how Ralph Lavin got on the board and how this worked. And this comes in a part where in the early 20s, the Ku Klux Klan was kind of running wild through Kern County and actually much of Los Angeles County and parts of the Bay Area. And there were eventually some grand jury investigations, and there were a whole bunch of names that were released of politicians and sheriffs and other folks, elected officials, who had been unmasked as Ku Klux Klan members. And most of them resigned, but not Stanley Abel. He actually stood up, and there's a long passage, and it ends like this. This was when he was identified as a Klan member. He said, "I make no apology for the Klan. It needs none." And he was actually reelected then. So I'm just going to pick up there and read a little bit that'll just kind of set this divide in this smaller context of the board. In August, with its ranks unmasked, the Klan pulled back in Kern County, and in the fall, an embarrassed and fed-up citizenry recalled from office a number of politicians, including several city councilmen, the city clerk, the mayor, and a justice of the peace. Of those placed on the ballot, only one survived, Stanley Abel. If he was at all humbled by the experience, he didn't show it. Over the next 15 years, Abel continued to consolidate his base of power so that even when he didn't hold the chairmanship of the Board of Supervisors, it was apparent that he was in charge. Most of those elected to join him on the board were cast in his mold anyway, conservative good old boys dressed up in suits and ties, instinctively pro-agribusiness and anti-labor. In 1938, a tiny crack developed in Abel's machine. 45-year-old Ralph Lavin, a self-described progressive, won a spot as a supervisor. Lavin, who had served as San Joaquin Valley campaign manager for the reform-minded Robert M. La Follette during his 1924 presidential run, had tried once before to get elected to the board, but was unsuccessful. This time, with strong backing from the unions, he made it, a local manifestation of the same groundswell that had catapulted Culbert Olson into the governor's office. Rail thin and willing to flash a big grin for the cameras, Lavin was Abel's opposite in every way. But he was no bug-eyed radical, an army veteran who'd talk up the importance of patriotism. Lavin would later introduce a motion to deny welfare or a government job to, quote, any person who refuses to salute our flag in all sincerity and who cannot subscribe or offer his oath of allegiance to our Constitution. His idea of relaxation was to pore over copies of the congressional record. During his run for office in 1938, he trumpeted his credentials as a pharmacy owner, saying that his acumen for sound business administration was precisely what the county government needed. Yet Lavin, more than the other supervisors, had empathy for the less fortunate, in part because he had been there himself. During the depths of the Depression, Lavin lost his two drugstores. He wound up as a record keeper with the Works Progress Administration, but money was still so tight his daughter, Hallie Killebrew, would remember the reverberations for the rest of her life. The family having to move out of their house and into a small apartment, her father being forced to give up the country club and golf, their Hudson falling apart so that her dad had to walk to the WPA, his thumbs stuck in the lower pockets of his vest, a hole appearing on the top of his black shoe that he disguised by rubbing polish into his sock. It was during this period that Lavin had his first head-to-head encounter with Stanley Abel and the supervisors. He had gone before the board to bring to light circumstances that he thought were patently unfair. Lavin had learned of a man who operated a thriving drugstore in Bakersfield and also held the contract for the apothecary at the County General Hospital. He asked why this guy had two jobs when some people had none, Killebrew recounted. The supervisor's response, she said, was not what her father wanted to hear. They laughed at him. At that moment, Killebrew said, Lavin made up his mind that he was going to get on that board. When he finally did, having recovered some financially by landing a job with the Southern Pacific, he quickly realized that he'd have to stand his ground or he'd get steamrolled. The old guard, led by Abel, threatened to sack county workers who had voted for Lavin. You raise one finger to fire that man, the normally soft-spoken Lavin told them, his voice now booming, and I'll never rest until I get you. After that, they backed off. Most of the board's business was so mundane and bureaucratic that there was far more agreement than disagreement among Lavin and the other supervisors on official matters. But the resentment below the surface was palpable, especially between Lavin and Abel. There was no love lost there, Killebrew said. They differed so politically. Abel's ambush of the Grapes of Wrath was just the sort of thing that would set her dad off, grumbling as he came home, that damn Ku Kluxer. Lavin hadn't yet read the book when the ban was put into effect, but he soon would. And where Abel saw a story that was nothing more than a, quote, lie and a libel, Lavin discovered a tale that he knew to be all too true. But for the hand of fate or the grace of God, Lavin's wife Josephine inscribed in the copy of the novel she bought for him, the Jode family may have been us.
That's great. Now, you know, those folks, Abel and Lavin, seem almost dropped from central casting for you to create these polls, but I know better, and I expect everyone in the audience knows better, that it's the craft that you bring to the writing that helps to illustrate and bring these characters to life. But how do you know, other than the fact that you sussed it out, but how do you know that characters like these are going to occupy these polls for you? I mean, obviously, Abel went after the book, so he's there. But how do you find and then how do you flesh out characters like this and their role in this case and their representativeness for California or the Central Valley in the 30s?
Well, you know this well, right, is that, you know, life really is stranger than fiction. And, you know, the more you scratch at something, people are just, they're great characters. They really are there. And it's all about just scratching and digging and being persistent and really trying to make sure, you cover all your bases. So, you know, sometimes you get incredibly lucky with characters. A couple examples of luck. So one is, you know, again, you can't make this stuff up, right? So Stanley Abel, he's on the far right. And then he had a brother who was also on the far right, who actually, an older brother named Edson, who helped establish the Associated Farmers. So they were big right-wingers. Then it turns out he had two brothers who were on the far left. They were members of the ACLU in Kern County, right? And so, I mean, it was incredible. And I scratched, and it was LL and Ralph, and who were on the far left. And Ralph went on to become a labor organizer and a union chief at the borax mine, right, in the California desert. And I remember I was looking, and I went back through a series of obituaries. I actually started with headstone markers to find dates of death and cemeteries and then, you know, death notices to headstone markers to, you know, fact on family and da-da-da. And I finally found a niece who really remembered her uncles well. She's like the last surviving family member. Did you know Stanley? Yeah, I knew Stanley, you know, told me a little about him. And I said, you remember Ralph? Ralph, he was the commie in the family, you know? I mean, it's like, wow, this is fantastic. And sure enough, there's a picture in the book of the four, you know, brothers, and they're literally, two are standing on the right and two are standing on the left, and they don't look very happy to be standing together at all, and it's fantastic. And then so some of it's digging, you know, that way, and you know, it's hospital records and death records, and I've hired a private detective at times to help me hunt down people because they have better databases than you can get off the internet. And then it's sometimes just pure luck. And the, you know, the biggest piece of luck in this book, the one main character who is still alive, as far as I know, and was alive certainly as I was writing it, was the farm worker who actually, Bill Camp, his farm worker, who he had this then young man stick the novel in the fire, burn the Grapes of Wrath, guy who actually did the book burning. And his name is Clell Pruitt, and thank God his name is Clell Pruitt and not Sam Jones, because if you go to the internet white pages and you type in Clell Pruitt, one name comes up in the whole country. And I did that, and I thought, wow, this is incredible. And it was a guy in Missouri, and I called up, and he answered the phone, and I said, explain what I was doing, and he said, that's me.
Man.
And I asked him how old he was, and he told me he was about 90, and I said, are you going to be there tomorrow? Hang on, Clell. And I literally got on a plane and went and spent a day with Clell.
That's remarkable. So talk to us a little bit about the research skills you bring to this. I mean, you've got a background in journalism, you're an investigative reporter, you're clearly attracted by biography. First of all, is biography and biographical stories the major avenue by which you come up with your data? And then tell us a little bit about your own research skills now doing historical research on people both alive and dead.
You know, it's a real mix of things. I mean, I think journalism is obviously good training. You know, I still don't consider myself a historian, and it's really out of respect for the depth of scholarship that you and your colleagues bring to it. I remember you once called me a historian. I almost fell off my chair. So
I'll do it tonight.
So it's, you know, I think I don't, you know, honestly, I don't feel like I bring that. What I feel I do bring is mostly just a pretty insatiable curiosity, and, you know, I won't give up till I find these people, basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just keep going and going and going until I do.
How about you remarked that the book takes place over this really short period of time, reception and reaction to the book over essentially a week in the middle of the 30s or latter 1930s and early 1940s period. You wrote a book, The King of California, about the Boswell dynasty in the Central Valley. Some of the same characters, some of the same issues, some of the same landscape, but an entirely different chronology. What's the difference in telescoping a book down to this span of time versus the long kind of sprawling narrative of King of California?
That's a really good question. In some ways, maybe it's almost like in reverse, because the King of California, the kind of the front story is so sprawling, and it does take you to it's the front story that takes you to a lot of big places, but in a sense, you know, kind of what's, you know, it's just all there. I mean, it's all so big. This really is, again, the story's really narrow, but it's the backstory that's huge. It's the canvas that's huge. It's what the window looks onto that's huge. And that's when I knew that this was a book. I mean, it really wasn't The Grapes of Wrath in and of itself, the burning and banning of the Grapes of Wrath, is a compelling story, but it is a pretty narrow story. It's really only when I began to see the way these characters connected to these bigger events, and that this was emblematic of these bigger issues and a great way to talk about this larger tussle between left and right, that I knew I had a book. And then it got fun, because then it was all about how could you structure a narrative over the course of a week. Well, I sort of ended up doing it day by day, and then I realized there were all these other things that connected. So one of the chapters takes you back, for example, to a court case in 1934. It was a seminal court case for the whole era. There were a group of labor organizers, openly communist labor organizers, who were arrested and indicted on charges of criminal syndicalism. This was a law in the books then where you could go to jail for openly advocating, not doing, but advocating the violent overthrow of the government or the capitalist system. And there were hundreds of people, you know, who spent serious jail time through the teens. This was right initially a reaction to the Wobblies, to the IWW, and then kept on moving through the teens, 20s, 30s, and California, once again, was the leading state in the nation in terms of prosecutions for criminal syndicalism. And so there's this case, and I knew I wanted to use this case, and there's a lawyer, a blind attorney, who's one of my favorite characters in the book, named Ray Henderson. Ray Henderson was the ACLU lawyer in Kern County. He spoke out against the Grapes of Wrath the censorship of the Grapes of Wrath, excuse me, and it's just this wonderful character, this brave man, this ACLU attorney. And at some point I realized he had been a lawyer in this earlier case, and I knew about the case, and I thought, wow, this is great. He now takes me to the case, and he's this way I can connect the dot, and I can explore this case, which I really wanted to write about. But I still needed in the context of this week to do it. So again, you sort of get lucky or you make your own luck. So in the case file up in Sacramento, there's a thing where during this very week in 1939, Earl Warren, the attorney general, is returning evidence, boxes of evidence, to all the lawyers involved in this case from 5 years earlier. And it's during this very week he writes, "Dear Ray Henderson, here's all your documents back, blah, 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 blah." So it just became this very, you know, natural way to say, in the midst of this tussle over the Grapes of Wrath, it was an easy narrative hook. Here comes the documents that very week, and then boom, you have this whole window into this very seminal event.
Did you know when you started writing that it would be a week-long story, as opposed to a year, a two-year, three-year?
The outline came, I don't know, maybe a year or so in. Uh-huh. I mean, for a while, I don't know how you work, but I think for a while you're just casting your net really wide. And you're just gathering up and scooping up everything you can get your hands on that's roughly related. And the trick is not to go down too many rabbit holes, because mm-hmm. so much is interesting, you know, and you can really waste a lot of time just chasing things that'll never go anywhere near the book. But then, you know, if you can be disciplined enough, you begin to narrow it down. So I think it was about a year in that I sort of saw, there was enough ways during this week that I could connect to the big events I wanted to connect to.
Most of you in the room may know that the movie follows very quickly upon the publication of the book, and Daryl Zanuck gets a hold of it, and Henry Fonda's cast as Tom Joad, and a lot of the literary and cinematic criticism says that the movie toned down the radicalism, particularly of Tom Joad, in the novel. Did you ever care to tackle reaction and response to the movie, and was it ever anything close to this kind of rabid response?
I don't think it was once the movie came out, at least not that I found, and it wasn't locally. But there is quite a bit about the movie in the book, and the reason is that part of the supervisor's resolution in Kern County was they actually asked 20th Century Fox not to make the film. Didn't get very far with that. It's a very polite letter from 20th Century Fox saying sorry. But the film itself, first of all, you're right, it did happen incredibly quickly. The novel came out in April of 1939, and the screenplay, Nunnally Johnson's screenplay, was done by July, finished. So it was fast.
And Jane Fonda to this day says it was her father's favorite role, most important role of his career.
And a wonderful performance. And there was a lot of controversy over the film, again, because of all the controversy we talked about in terms of obscenity, in terms of socialism that was a lot of people thought was promoted in The Grapes of Wrath. It was something of a top secret project for Fox. So they actually, when they went out on the road, they pretended they were making another movie, that it wasn't The Grapes of Wrath. They had all these, you know, subterfuges going on. There was so much controversy that Look magazine in November of 39, there's an article, it's great, the headline is The Grapes of Wrath Too Hot for Hollywood? And it actually, there are folks from all sides of this debating whether the film should even be made. And what's great is that Daryl Zanuck, who produced the film and really was the force that moved it forward, he didn't waver for a second. And this was not a guy who was, you know, far to the left by any means. He was known to be a lifelong Republican, but he clearly did have a lot of sympathy for the real Joads of the world, and he thought that their story was important to tell. I've read in several places, and I cited in my book, that the first thing he did after reading the novel was he sent some detectives out, some Pinkertons or something, to go see whether what Steinbeck had written about was true, and they came back and said it's worse, and that's when he decided to make the movie.
Well, and there were many ways to try to head off the impact and the crashing kind of truthfulness of the book. And so, as Rick knows and writes about, the state put out a book called, to head off The Grapes of Wrath, put out a book called The Grapes of Gladness, about literally about the Hoad family, which was very happy in California and doing just fine. But that kind of response, feeble, interesting as can be, but feeble, invites a question that I want Rick to reflect upon about getting in the mindset of these characters. You know them very well. They're very beautifully rendered. Their humanity comes out. They're sympathetic characters all across the political spectrum in the book. But a character like Bill Camp, we would look, I think today, almost universally, I think, upon the burning of books as a vindictive, impetuous act, sure to backfire. What's the purpose of burning the book? I mean, is it a show of burning a single copy to assess a kind of, or to show off a sort of a local antagonism and say, we're not going to take this anymore? Or does it have a kind of stratagem to it that they think some productive good will come out of it?
Yeah, I think there are two answers, but I should just mention, because it is funny, and there's a whole part about these counter books that were written to Steinbeck's novels. So right, so there was Grapes of Gladness, and actually it was written by that one was by Marshall Hartranft, who was a sort of utopian dreamer. He was part of the Little Landers movement in California, and his whole idea, this idea to settle folks in these rural colonies, the migrants would come and settle in rural colonies, and they would really therefore be provided. They'd have an acre of land and be able to take care of themselves. He also happened to be a real estate developer. It's a classic California story, really. So, you know, it's hard to, I describe him as both dreamer and dream monger, and I think that's what he was. There was the Kern County Chamber of Commerce put out a film called Plums of Plenty. Lest anyone, you know, sort of wonder what that was about. There were some other anti-Steinbeck tracts that came out at the time. And then there was a book, fairly serious attempt, although it's a horrible book, called Of Human Kindness by a prominent writer of the day named Ruth Comfort Mitchell. And this is about the Banner family, and they really take care of their farm workers, and then this horrible communist comes into their midst, and she kills a local teacher and corrupts their son, and, you know, and it's really awful.
Should point out, too, that the novel, The Grapes of Wrath, has an original title. The original manuscript that Steinbeck destroys is called L'Affaire Lettuceburg.
Right.
Which is a terrible title.
Yeah, yeah. And the Great Pig Sticking was the other one.
Yeah, The Great Pig Sticking,
The other one that he...
But so how about the mindset of these people?
The burning itself, I think there are two reasons books are burned historically, right? One is to really to create fear, right? So if you're the Nazis and you burn thousands of books in the public square, it's an act of fascism and terrorism, and it's to, right, promote terror. In this case, it was actually strategic. The Grapes of Wrath was burned in this case, right? Remember, it wasn't Bill Camp, the big farmer, the big grower, who stuck the book in the fire. He had his farm worker, Clell Pruitt, stick the book in the fire. And that's really important. And it's important because what he was trying to say and what he wanted to show, and there is some truth to this. It's not just we, the big growers, the associated farmers, who are offended by this book. It's the migrants themselves who don't like the way they were portrayed by John Steinbeck. See, we're sticking up for the migrants. And that was, I think, what the strategy was. And again, there's some truth to that. There are a number of folks from that community, not many living now, some who came as children. But I've read a lot of oral histories. There was a great oral history project done in the 70s by Cal State Bakersfield, the Odyssey Project, which is hundreds of interviews that are all at Cal State Bakersfield, all easily accessible. And it's amazing the number of folks who made that trip who didn't like The Grapes of Wrath. Lots certainly thought it was empathetic and sympathetic, and that Steinbeck portrayed them with great dignity and humanity and strength and courage. But a lot of folks said, Tom Joad, he was a murderer. I wasn't raised to talk like that. Those people were uncouth. He made us look like hayseeds. You know, they didn't like it at all. And so there was some ambivalence in the community, and getting Clell Pruitt to burn the book as opposed to one of the farmers sticking it in was very significant.
And I'll raise the question about the Joads here in just a second, but in your approach to this, you're very familiar and learned about the Central Valley and the 30s and the Depression and the struggles thereof. Is it a long time ago? I mean, part of our task as historians is to remind our students that the past is not particularly long ago. Does it feel like a long time ago as you complete this book and think about those issues?
Yes and no. You know, thank God we're not in the 30s. Thank God it's not a depression. And I don't think anyone would... a real depression. I mean, I'm being serious, where you know, unemployment isn't, you know, at 17.5% the way it was in 1939. I mean, misery was ubiquitous in a real way. You know, this was, you know, a lot of the economic indicators in 39 were no better than they had been in 1929 at the start of the Great Depression. I mean, these were tough, tough, tough times, right? Hungry years. And the solutions that people are you know, trying to deal with now to deal with, you know, some of the same issues on some level aren't what they were then. There's not a lot of serious folks I know. I mean, these were mainstream leading intellectuals who were talking about ending the capitalist system and replacing it with some form of socialism. I mean, you really don't hear too many folks talking about that in the same way. So it's not the same time. But boy, it really is the same time in some other ways. And it is amazing how the Jodes carry on. I mean, just a couple weeks ago, the flooding that happened in Iowa, there were about 120 electrical workers who left Detroit. They traveled hundreds of miles to go down to Cedar Rapids to help the folks who had been flooded out down there. And they did this in part to lend a hand, but they did it a lot to help themselves. And I actually have a piece that's going to run in the Times about this on the op-ed page. And they went there really because they can't find auto industry jobs anymore. They're really hard up. So they were willing to go and travel and live in tent cities, you know, amidst all this muck and water, because they needed a job. And as they left, Harley Shaken, the UC Berkeley labor expert, you know, he likened them immediately, right? One image came to his mind, and he said, what's happening in Detroit now is the same thing that happened to the Jodes in Oklahoma. And so the Jodes do live on in a lot of ways. You know, we're at a time now where we've income inequality in this country is at its greatest point since 1928. You know, wages are stagnant. You know, people are really struggling in a lot of cases just to make ends meet for basic necessities. And so, you know, I think the Jodes do live on. I actually write a little about this at the end of the book. I'm just going to read this.
Yeah, by all means.
And what I do is I sort of come back and since Louise already told you the punchline of the story, the book ends up, it gets reinstated into Kern County Libraries in 1941. And I use the last sort of section of the book. I go to actually to, there's a festival which is coming up in a couple weeks. If any of you want to go to Arvin, California, just south of Bakersfield, it's the Dust Bowl Days Festival. And it's great. A lot of folks who are part of this migrant community come back and they go to the old labor camp where Steinbeck himself did a lot of his research. And there's still the Sunset School there where a lot of these folks went to school as little kids. And they celebrate now. It's gone from sort of, you know, what James Gregory calls Oki Chic. You know, it's now Oki Chic. So they come back and they dance and have a little festival. So I go there and I kind of set this last stage where I catch you up on what happened after this burning and banning of the Grapes of Wrath. What happens to all the main characters in the book? So I'm just going to read a little bit about what happened to Steinbeck and then end with this, if that's all right. John Steinbeck's first inclination after finishing the Grapes of Wrath was to forget about politics. As he set out to write his next book, the taxonomic travelogue Sea of Cortez, he seemed wistful about escaping the tumult that had characterized the preceding period. The world is sick now, he wrote to his friend Carlton Sheffield in November 1939. There are things in the tide pools easier to understand than Stalinist, Hitlerite, Democrat, capitalist confusion and voodoo. Over the years, however, Steinbeck moved ever more to the right, or at least that's how his critics perceived it. By the late 1960s, with a Nobel Prize in Literature now to his name, Steinbeck was seen by many on the left as a traitor. They criticized him for being manifestly middle class. He did rent a fancy sports car during a trip to Europe, dubbing himself and his wife the Jodes and the Jag. Some were dismayed by his anti-Marxist comments, others by his hawkish stance on Vietnam. In truth, what Steinbeck had contested and would always contest was any repression of a person's spirit, be it at the hands of the Associated Farmers or Stalin's secret police. I believe in and will fight for the right of the individual to function as an individual without pressure from any direction, he wrote in 1954. Still, there was no question that the rage that had fueled Steinbeck's greatest novel cooled over time. When I wrote The Grapes of Wrath, he told The Voice of America, I was filled naturally with certain anger at people who were doing injustices to other people, or so I thought. I realize now that everyone was caught in the same trap. If you remember, we had a depression at the time. The depression caught us without the ability to take care of it. Stricken by clogged arteries, John Steinbeck died in New York in December 1968. His ashes were scattered over the California coast. As the sun lowered over the Dust Bowl Days festival, the Western Swingsters played a few last songs before packing up their instruments. It was time to go home. The slow road toward Highway 99 wound past some rundown farm worker settlements, occupied by men and women who journeyed from deep inside Mexico to pick clean the same fields the Okies once had. Just to the north lay Bakersfield, where the Kern County Board of Supervisors in 2002 had issued a proclamation declaring October Reading the Grapes of Wrath Month. Some greeted their action as if it were an apology for their predecessor's ill-conceived book ban. Others would invoke Kern County's history of censorship a year later, when a group of local parents tried to keep Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye from being taught in their children's high school, one of the 2,000 or so books challenged every year around the country. In his letter to Carlton Sheffield, Steinbeck had said that, with the Grapes of Wrath behind him, he was ready to write about things which, quote, are relatively more lasting. But on the 4,000-foot climb back toward L.A., it was hard not to marvel at how enduring the Grapes of Wrath has been. It isn't just the 100,000 copies of the book that are still sold each year, or the way the Joads have continued to penetrate popular culture, thanks to Bruce Springsteen and Rage Against the Machine. For many, The Grapes of Wrath remains the quintessential story of dignity in the face of adversity. Then again, maybe it's something else that has made the book so ageless. In a country where nearly 40 million people don't always have enough food, where about a third of the population doesn't earn an adequate amount to cover basic necessities, and where income inequality is wider now than at any time since before the Great Depression, the central conundrum of capitalism is not much different than it was in 1939. How can there be so much want amid so much plenty? Our people, wrote Steinbeck, are good people. Our people are kind people. Pray God someday kind people won't all be poor. Pray God someday a kid can eat. Pray God someday we won't have such a need to remember the Joads.
Well, with that, I certainly would like to thank Rick for writing such a lyrical, smart, historically accurate, and compelling book, both for its illustration of a period 70 and 80 years ago, but also for the obvious ties and sinews that connect us to the past. And it's really quite a wonderful, poignant, and smart book. I'd like to thank you all and thank the always wonderful Aloud series for bringing us all together and invite you for your comments and questions. And with that, please wait for the microphones to appear for you to ask your question. There is no dumb or silly question. There is a long question. but please please feel free to make a comment or ask a question of Rick. Oh, sure. Right here, this gentleman right here, the blue shirt and the tie.
Thank you very much. Two very quick questions, the ones you didn't answer, I guess. When the book was burned in Bakersfield, was it just one copy or were they burying a pile of books? And the other question I didn't hear you talk about was the farm worker Clell
Pruitt.
Pruitt. Did he want to burn the book or was he kind of encouraged by his employer?
Two good questions. Everyone hear the questions? Yeah, okay, great. So it was not a big Nazi-style book burning. It was really a photo op. Bill Camp summoned the local newspaper photographer. It was one copy dropped in a pail, and that was it. Show over, as far as I know. So it wasn't a big thing. Interestingly, Clell Pruitt had never read the book till I brought him a copy, which is pretty telling about probably a lot of book burners. But what he did say was a couple things. He said, one, he had heard about it and sure didn't like the way it sounded. And what he meant by that, as I drew him out, was that guy made it so all the bosses were mistreating, so it seemed like they were mistreating their workers. Well, Bill Camp did all right by me. It was tough times. He gave me a job. Wasn't the nicest guy in the world, but wasn't the meanest guy in the world. He actually provided one of the better living conditions for Clell, which was in a boxcar. He was kind of in the pecking order of farm laborers in Bill Camp's operation. If you live in a tent, most folks live in tents, and the ones who had a little more seniority actually lived in rail cars. and he and his wife lived in a rail car, and he said it was a roof over our head. It was a job. He wasn't that bad a guy. I also found this was really interesting, and I jogged his memory with it. In Bill Camp's papers, which I discovered at Clemson, there was a file on this whole period. And there's a contemporaneous letter written this week. Ruth Comfort Mitchell, the author I mentioned who wrote Of Human Kindness, she goes and gives a major radio address condemning the Grapes of Wrath. This thing is broadcast up and down the coast. This is a big deal in San Francisco. And hundreds of people packed in, and it's this whole big, big show. And Clell Pruitt listened to the thing on the radio. And there's a letter from an Associated Farmers publicity guy saying, there's this farm worker named Clell Pruitt writing to Camp. He's one of your guys, and he heard that radio broadcast, and it quotes Pruitt as saying, boy, that woman gave it to him good, and I'm ready to do something here. So he got fired up.
We had a question in the back. Okay. Up here. Oh,
by the way, if I can just add one thing. So I did call Clell back and say, so did you read the book? And he said he did read it, and he said, I still don't like it.
This gentleman here, yeah.
I was wondering if there was any similar outrage to Dorothea Lange's documentation of migrant farm workers in that area during the same time.
That's a great question, right? Because really, you know, the enduring images of, in a lot of ways, certainly California in the 30s, but really America in the 30s. I mean, when you think about it, you know, probably in my mind, the two most lasting images are Tom Joad, you know, and whatever that conjures, and it probably, you know, right, conjures Fonda in the film. But it's Migrant Mother, right, is the other photograph, is Dorothea Lange's photograph. And there actually was, but later, a lot of controversy around Migrant Mother. And it was interesting, and it reflected in some ways, and I speak to this in the book, I actually interviewed one of her daughters. And the controversy came out. I didn't discover the controversy, but I talked to her about it. And it's one of the daughters, then very little girl, pictured in the photograph, right, snuggling with their forlorn mom. And a couple things about it. One is it later came out, and this was years later in the 70s, that this woman wasn't really as bad off as actually the newspaper, you know, sort of cut line that went with the photograph made it, that she didn't live in this rundown pea pickers camp, as Dorothea Lange's field notes had said. She actually, her car happened to break down there, and she was on her way somewhere else. She was a woman with a lot of dignity who was a labor organizer, et cetera, et cetera. And her daughter said she hated that photograph because it made her, she was a woman who really thought that she had a lot of positive things going on. Yeah, they were poor. Yeah, they were struggling. But again, they didn't see dignity in that photograph. They felt like it just showed one side of their mom and their family, and they didn't like it.
Right here.
Could you talk a little bit about the librarian and specifically, did she have any repercussions because she objected to the banning?
Yeah, Gretchen Neef, who was the librarian, a wonderfully heroic figure, real heroine in the book. You know, she did something incredibly brave. The day that the banning came out, she wrote a very powerful letter. I mean, it's poetry to all the members of the board. And she served at the pleasure of the Board of Supervisors. And she wrote a letter talking about how foolish this was. And I think Louise quoted a little bit from it in her introduction. Incredibly brave. She was kind of poked fun at by Stanley Abel during some of the proceedings that were to follow. She was sort of marginalized. Nothing ever happened to her. She did get reprimanded at one point, and this was why. After the banning, Kern County had 60 copies of the novel, I believe, that were in its collection in the library system. So she had to recall them all. And the book was in such demand that she started getting calls from other libraries all over the state saying, can we get your copies? We can use them. And she lent out all 60 copies. And at some point along the way, Stanley Abel discovered this and accused her of stealing county property and gave her a good chewing out. And she had to recall all the books so that they would sit and collect dust in Kern County. So she went on. She actually served. She was still librarian. She somehow put up with all this. She didn't write or talk a lot about it. She actually wrote a book on library, running county libraries, and talks a little bit, and I quote in here, about censorship and how one can sort of cope with it, but it doesn't allude at all to this episode. She went on to become, she served till 41 and was able to actually reinstate the novel, which is great that she stuck around that long. She left soon thereafter. She became the state librarian in Washington State. And it was really something, as I discovered, she's like a rock star of the library world. I mean, librarians know Gretchen Neef, you know, it's great. And then Gretchen went on. She, her husband had a, they had a farm in Alabama, and she went to Alabama with him, became a library consultant, and interestingly continued to fight. In the 50s, she worked to desegregate libraries in Alabama.
Yeah. There's a biography in there, I think. Right here.
I was just wondering, when the KKK was doing their work, did they do any lynchings? Because I had heard that there were lynchings in California.
You know, I didn't come across that. I was looking at one pretty particular period in Kern County to Stanley Abel's, you know, kind of reign of terror in the KKK there in the 1922. And I don't recall discovering any lynchings. Most of it was they were self-appointed vigilantes who were going to quote unquote clean up the county. So they took on anyone they deemed objectionable. So, you know, they threw out drunks. Undoubtedly, they threw out people of color or anyone who didn't, you know, agree with them on, you know, on any other issue. But anyone who, you know, if a woman was suspected of cheating on her husband, she was run out of town. The guy was run out of town. I mean, it was, but it was real nasty, as you would imagine, and it was violent. But I don't know of any lynchings per se.
Justin, let's go top, and then here. Oh. Okay, got one over here? Okay, go for it. And then we'll come back.
I just wanted to ask you back to the present. A couple of years ago, I think, was the LA Times had a whole series of stories on migrant workers living in Kern County, living in basically 10 cities with no water and whatever. And I just wanted to make it, you know, the observation that this year, I think it was within 2008, 5 farm workers have died on the fields in California due to conditions in the fields.
Yep.
Have you been to these, have you observed those places in Kern County? I was just curious.
I haven't seen any conditions up close that badly. When I ran West Magazine at the Times, we ran an incredibly compelling story by Mark Arax, you know, which was about the death, called The Summer of the Death of Hilario Guzman, which was about a farm worker who died in the fields. So yeah, this stuff still happens. You know, sometimes it's lack of water, sometimes it's, you know, folks who are traveling in these vans in completely unsafe conditions, that, you know, where their employers or the labor contractors, in many cases, you know, turned a blind eye, and they're riding on benches that are, you know, half nailed down in the backs of vans, and it's very unsafe and really terrible. What is amazing, and this is in some ways the way the world does stand still, you know, if you drive out to that valley. You know, whether it's Kern County and all the way up, you know, through the breadth of the heartland of this state, you know, you catch it on the right day, right, where the Thule fog's kind of rolling, and, I mean, you think you are in a Dorothea Lange photograph. I mean, the place, right, the physical labor, it's remarkably unchanged. And it's just been wave after wave, you know. It was folks from Asia, and then, right, it was, you know, all kinds of folks from various parts of Europe and, you know, and it's been Mexican steadily and, you know, throughout different times, and, you know, folks out of the Dust Bowl and some, you know, blacks out of the Southwest, and they've all come, and it's just been wave after wave. And now, you know, what you tend to find is it's folks who have the least voice. It's always those who have the least voice because it's the least desirable job. It's terrible, backbreaking work. So now, right, even the Mexican community, you know, it's not folks who speak Spanish anymore who are picking crops, right? It's folks who speak indigenous language, whether it's Mixtec or whatever, that, you know, who are doing the picking. So it's an ongoing story. It's a great observation.
Let's go right there and then right here and two more. Okay, here and here.
If someone were new to California, a layperson, and they just wanted to educate themselves in an entertainable way, this is for both of you, do you have places that you would suggest they visit that are very evocative of California history or And are there particular novels or nonfiction that you'd recommend they read to get a good understanding?
I'll let you do this one.
That's a great question. Certainly Grapes of Wrath, and then if you go backwards in time, Steinbeck writes in this naturalistic tradition that Frank Norris writes in. They both set out to write the great American novel. They both, in some respects, succeed a generation apart in California. So
the
Frank
octopus,
Norris's
right?
The Octopus is a wonderful, evocative, somewhat stilted for our language today in a kind of Victorian or late Victorian way, but quite a wonderful novel about the imposition of an industrial force, the railroad, on a pastoral landscape. And then Steinbeck's is the next phase of that, in a sense, the industrial, quote-unquote, industrial laborers in the countryside and what happens to them. So I would certainly start with those. In some respects, those are kind of bookends of the first part of the 20th century. And then in terms of places,
I got
it's a
one.
Really interesting question. Yeah.
So I got a good place. So my friends who I've been trying to drag, who I've never gotten there, will all laugh at me, those who are here. But you want to just go over the hill 90 minutes away and see totally the other California on a Friday night or a Saturday night. Just go to Bakersfield and go to Buck Owens' Crystal Palace. Unfortunately, Buck isn't around anymore, but the Buckaroos still play, as far as I know, every Friday and Saturday night. And it really, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's a different world, and it's an hour and a half drive, and it's just a completely different world.
And by the same token, if you can make that a weekend trip, go to Kettleman City and see the oil landscape mixed with the cotton and other agricultural landscape. That'll give you a real good sense of California, I think. And then our last question was right here.
It's been a really fantastic discussion. I'd like to thank you both. But I'm really intrigued. What are the kind of books that people are trying to ban now?
Harry Potter, for one, right? Often on banned books lists. Steinbeck still, sometimes for Of Mice and Men, sometimes for The Grapes of Wrath.
Catcher still, in the Rye.
Still makes it a lot. A lot of it's, sometimes it's language. It's more tends to be sexuality today. Sometimes it is, in the case of Harry Potter, it's, concerns about that it's witchcraft or, things like that that are seeping in.
You still get at the K through 5 level some turmoil about the household with two dads or two moms. You'll find that kind of gender and sexual identity debates at the. In my understanding, this is naive in a sense, I don't really know. My understanding is that a lot of the pressure upon books tends to come now more at the earlier levels, the K through 5 levels, with the increased involvement of parents into book decisions and books in the classroom, as opposed to the time when I grew up.
But it is really something important to be aware of. We are headed to Banned Books Week. And again, I reference this in the reading at the end. The American Library Association counts officially anywhere from 400 to 600 books that are challenged every year by public bodies around the country. And that's what they know of. But they estimate there are 4 to 5 times that many because they don't know about most of them. So it goes on quite a bit. It's kind of stunning.
Well, with that, I think I... Louise, one last question? Okay, you're on. But we need the microphone, because I think we're taping.
What would you say to high school teachers today challenged with teaching the Grapes of Wrath?
Anyone hear that?
What would you say to high school teachers who were challenged teaching the Grapes of Wrath? I would tell them to keep on fighting and teach it. It's obviously a classic. It's an important book. And, this is a long discussion. I mean, there are teachers who can make individual decisions in their classroom, knowing their class and what they're comfortable doing. And they may make different decisions about all kinds of books. What I have a problem with is when any government body is the one setting those parameters and ordering certain books not to be taught. So, everybody should read it, and for those of you who haven't read it in a while, read The Grapes of Wrath again. It holds up amazingly well.
As does Obscene in the Extreme. Please join me in thanking Rick.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM
KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Allowed theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.